Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, March 5th, 2018. UN says insecurity in Upper Nile has forced thousands of families from their homes.
I would highlight Akobo, where we receive in that general vicinity reports of conflict, and aid agencies are there to meet the needs of populations when they're displaced. So sometimes hundreds, thousands of people move as a result of conflict.
And women leaders in Jonglei State are calling on the state officials to implement gender equality.
Kirmayadit granted us was 10%, so a total of 35%. In Jonglei State government, which is a cabinet, there's no even single woman. 9 men in a cabinet.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A new report by The Sentry says South Sudan's leaders use the country's oil wealth to get rich and terrorize civilians. The report says records reviewed by The Sentry shows how the country's oil is used to fuel militias and ongoing atrocities across the country. J.R. Maley is the author of the report entitled Fueling Atrocities, Oil and War in South Sudan. He says there are networks of companies and individuals involved in financing the violence in South Sudan.
What we're seeing is Stephen Dudow, who in 2014 through 2016 was the Minister of Petroleum, his office coordinated the supply of food, fuel, and other equipment to Padang Dinka militias in Upper Nile State. At the time, those militias were responsible for attacks against civilians and widespread allegations of human rights violations and other atrocities. We're also seeing family members of top officials, for example, First Lady Mary Ayen and a wife of the former SPLA Chief of Staff Paul Malong, Ajak Wolitek, and others who own companies that receive payments for services in support of the military. So in effect, these top officials, you know, and their families are not only prosecuting a war, but they're benefiting financially from it at the same time.
You recommended that targeting multiple actors will help to bring peace in South Sudan. Who are these actors and how effective is that approach?
So what we're saying is that if you just put one person's name on a list for sanctions, they're likely, you know, just going to use a company or a relative or something. So what we're saying is map the entire network that's responsible for violence or atrocities or diverting government revenue and place sanctions on the whole network. In this case, we're seeing Stephen Dudow being well-informed and according to the UN panel of experts, responsible for funding militia. Then there's the militia commander, Tor Ejuat Dang, who is in close communication with them. There's members of Stephen Dudow's staff. Then there are the companies that are providing services to the military operations and unity in Upper Nile State that we're seeing. So, in effect, you know, you can't just go after the decision makers. You should go after the entire network that's responsible for carrying out those decisions.
The oil sector in South Sudan is a source of revenue for the country. You are also recommending sectorial sanctions. Can this really work? Is it not going to hurt the common people?
So, you know, in a few countries around the world, the United States has placed sectoral sanctions on the oil sector in particular, in, say, Venezuela or in Russia, in ways that haven't harmed average citizens. They can, you know, in very complex and careful ways, prevent major oil companies from, you know, being able to access certain types of financing or, you know, making it so that future oil blocks can't be leased or something like that. What we're suggesting is that the U.S. and other governments should find an appropriate package and program for South Sudan that prevents top officials from diverting oil revenue so that it can be used to enrich those responsible for the war and to carry out the war itself. We think this is possible. It wouldn't be a complete embargo. It wouldn't be a halt of oil sales from South Sudan, but it would make it more difficult to abuse the country's oil revenue.
And how about the role of banks? You know, Ugandan banks and Kenyan banks are doing business in South Sudan, and It appears like some of these transactions were going through these banks. What do you expect from the banks to help in this approach?
You know, banks have a responsibility to do customer due diligence and to make sure that the money that's moving through their coffers is clean. And, you know, banks shouldn't need to be told by a government that they shouldn't do business with war criminals or companies that are responsible for atrocities or supporting the forces that commit atrocities. So, you know, without naming any specific bank, I think all of the banks that are doing business in South Sudan should really step up their due diligence efforts. They should make sure that they're compliant with anti-money laundering regulations, and they should be really carefully scrutinizing transactions that involve top officials in South Sudan and members of their families, especially if those transactions involve moving large amounts of money, particularly overseas, to buy real estate and luxury goods, because we've seen that as a pattern when we've looked at, you know, the families of Salva Kiir and Paul Malong and Malik Ruben Riak and so forth. So banks have a key gatekeeper role.
There are also other reports that talk about the role of the neighbors of South Sudan, that is Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, Uganda. They have also been involved in the search for peace in South Sudan. What do you want leaders in these countries to do in order to help with these sectorial sanctions?
You know, they should follow up on the information that's collected and advisories that are issued by financial intelligence units in their countries and other countries around the world. And they should focus their resources on, you know, sectors where corruption and money laundering is prominent in South Sudan, like the oil sector or the foreign exchange sector or the construction sector. And they should really make sure to scrutinize those transactions so that they can allow legitimate transactions to pass through, but catch ones that could be the proceeds of corruption or embezzlement.
That's J.R. Meili, Director for Special Investigations at the Sentry, an investigative initiative co-founded by George Clooney and John Prendergast, which follows the money in order to create consequences for those funding and profiting from genocide or other mass atrocities in Africa. The Sentry also seeks to build leverage for peace. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says continued fighting between government and opposition forces in January and February have forced thousands of people to flee their homes in the Upper Nile region. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Ian Ridley, the head of UN OCHA in South Sudan, says 8 agencies are working to provide life-saving assistance to around 9,000 civilians who have been displaced from their homes following clashes between the government and opposition forces in multiple locations in the Upper Nile region. Ridley says 8 agencies are providing food, water, and shelter to families displaced by fighting.
So, for example, right now, aid agencies are working in Jonglei. I would highlight Akobo, where we receive in that general vicinity reports of conflict, and aid agencies are there to meet the needs of populations when they're displaced. So sometimes hundreds, thousands of people move as a result of conflict in an area.
UN OCHA says from 9th to 26th of January this year, fighting erupted in Uai, Uror, Nyirol, and Akobo, forcing some civilians to flee to neighboring Ethiopia as refugees. The UN says Jonglei State and Koch County in the former Unity State are among some of the affected areas. UN OCHA says a UN-run Protection of Civilians or POC site in Bor also registered 60 people and new arrivals fled from the villages of Walgak, Tanyang, and Podoch in Akobo County. Various South Sudanese armed groups continue to fight after signing the cessation of hostilities agreement in December last year. South Sudan's military spokesman, Brigadier General Lulu Roy Kwang, disputed the UN OCHA's report, claiming government forces were not involved in any violence.
The time that both parties were negotiating in Addis Ababa, starting from 22nd December to 25th, and I was the first who came out informing the whole world about the violations that were being carried out by different opposition fighters. And we were proven right that the violations in many parts of the country were carried out by the opposition fighters, especially in Kuch.
The SPLA-IO deputy military spokesman, Colonel Lampaul Gabriel, confirmed fighting took place in January in the areas mentioned in the UN OCHA's report. Gabriel says the visit by First Vice President Taban Dengai to Jonglei in January with a huge number of soldiers escalated fighting in the area.
The clash happened, but we did not orchestrate it. The SPLA-IO did not start it. The SPLA-IO has been on the defense. Because, you know, in our area, we have civilians, and we have to protect those civilians. So when you are attacked, what you do is defend the civilians and defend yourself. You cannot just let yourself be killed. So if they are saying there has been a clash between us, yes, there has been a clash between the SPLA-IO and the government or the regime in Juba, but it's not that we started it. We have been on the defense throughout.
SPLA-IO and the former detainees accused the first vice president, Taban Dengai, in January for violating the cessation of hostilities agreement signed by various South Sudanese parties in December. Deng's spokesman denied the accusation, saying the first vice president was on a peace mission. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Community leaders in Kajokeji say they are worried about the presence of heavily armed pastoralists from Jonglei State. The newly appointed governor of Yei River State, Emmanuel Adil Anthony, is warning the cattle keepers to peacefully vacate from farmlands or they will be removed by force. Daniel Martin Friday reports for VOA from Yei.
Reverend Stephen Taban of the Kajokeji Diocese of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan says the church has tried repeatedly to resolve the conflict between keepers and husk communities to no avail.
We struggle as a community and the church to make a dialogue with the bull communities. The raiding continue up to now. People were trying to come back to clean their houses, but now because of that movement, people move with heavy weapons and they are not soldier. People are now fearing and farming will not take place as people wish to. People want peace to reveal in their areas because they want to come back.
Taban says something must be done because armed cattle keepers in the farming communities present what he calls a serious security threat. Amos Longer is one of the community leaders in Kajokeji. He claims cattle keepers from Jonglei State have stolen more than 5,000 head of cattle in Kajokeji over the last years.
And this made it difficult for our community now to come and do some cultivation. As a result, even at the moment, is a threat. The community are fearing to come back. We would love both our government together with community leaders, let the cattle keepers please, one, return the cattle that have been taken to the rightful owners. Two, then they should leave the greater county of Kajokeji so that people are free to come and do some cultivation.
Apollo Gordon, the county commissioner of Kangapo, also claims cattle keepers from Jonglei State have stolen hundreds of cattle during the past 2 years. He alleged that cattle keepers killed 3 civilians and stole more than 800 head of cattle in the county recently.
Cattle raiders went as far as Gwari and brought in over 800 heads of cattle, including cattle from the Ugandan side. Cattle owners followed these cattle raiders and then 3 of them were killed. Reports say and that is a group from Bor who were roaming within that area between Fojulu area, Kajokeji area. These people were heavily armed. They were having guns. They were even in uniform. That was a threat.
South Sudan in Focus could not independently verify Gordon's allegations. Addressing a crowd at Yei Freedom Square last week upon returning from taking the oath of office in Juba, Governor Emmanuel Adil accused cattle raiders of crossing the South Sudan-Uganda border and looting cattle from Moyo District in Uganda. Last year, President Salva Kiir ordered all cattle keepers to leave the Equatorial region to allow farming communities to cultivate their land. Farmers in Yei River State say the president's order was never implemented. Speaking in Arabic, Governor Adil says that is going to change.
I got a report from Greater Kajokeji County. They are experiencing problems of cattle raiding. I also got a call from the RDC of Moyo District that armed cattle keepers from Kajokeji County looted cattle from his district, and I apologize to him. I want to call on the cattle keepers to leave the areas, and if they don't leave the area, we will take them out by force.
The governor says state authorities will apprehend cattle keepers committing crimes in Yei River State. South Sudan in Focus could not reach leaders of the cattle camps in Kajukeji villages to comment on the matter. In 2016, authorities in Jonglei State formed a committee to look into the repatriation of Jonglei cattle keepers from the Ikoshera region. Agot Aliar is the chairperson of the committee. Speaking by phone from the Jonglei area, Agot claims his office did not receive any information about cattle raiding in Kajukeji area. Agot is also appealing to the cattle herders to leave the Kajukeji area peacefully.
Based on the presidential decree, the cattle camps that are in Equatoria area are to relocate back to my state. So we are able to convey that message to the cattle camps and the government of the state. We are appealing to them to move back to the state peacefully, not to run into problems with the communities they will be crossing their territories, and especially the farming communities. As one people try to embrace the spirit of unity and oneness and try to come out from the culture of violence.
Yeh River State is part of the Greenbelt region, which is considered the breadbasket of South Sudan because of its potential large agricultural production. Farmers in the area fled to the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda last year after fighting government and rebels flat up in the parts of the state. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yeh.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, women in Jonglei State want more powers. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which African country do you admire most?
I admire Nigerians. They are very bold and they are go-getters.
I admire DRC Congo because of their music. They perform the best of music ever in Africa. Even though you don't understand what their language, but you admire their music.
I admire Ghana. It's my country, it's my motherland. Moreover, the culture of Ghanaians are unique. We are also very, very hospitable.
I love my country, South Sudan, and I'm so proud of it, despite of the ongoing ups and downs.
I admire Botswana, because Botswana is a good country, is a cool country. You know, they don't have this other corrupt, other things that are happening in other countries. They are like just like Switzerland in Europe, yeah.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Women leaders in Jonglei State are asking Governor Philip Aguer to implement the state's policy of allocating third of the state's position to women. Deng Gai Deng has the story for VOA from Juba.
The deputy chairperson of Jonglei State Land Commission says women believe they should be given the positions of deputy governor and at least two ministers. Elizabeth Awalininyal says gender violence should be shared, reflected in the state government institutions.
We are demanding the rights of women of Jonglei State because our late Dr. John granted us for 25%. And last year of 2016, our president, Kirmayadit, granted us was 10%. So a total of 35%. In Jonglei State government, which is a cabinet, there's no even single woman. 9 men in a cabinet.
Awali says there are enough qualified women in the state who can be appointed to important government positions.
The man who will say women are not capable, we can say 2010, we have 2 women. We have a minister, an advisor, which is a Honorable Susanna, and we have 2011, we have 2 women. Also in a cabinet. 2012, we have women in a cabinet. If it's English or Arabic or Dinka, we are capable. Or if they're looking for degrees, we are capable than other men.
Susan Lina Luong, chairperson of the SPLM Women Caucus in the Jonglei State Legislative Assembly, says there were more women represented in previous state government.
By the time of the governor, Honorable Kwalma Nyang-Yuk, we had 3 ministers and 1 advisor. So the number is every time going less. The second government, we had 2 ministers and no advisor. So we thank the previous governors, and now we are demanding our governor of this time to give us our rights, which is 35%.
Governor Aguirre confirms he has received the women's demand and promises to do something about their grievances.
We do not intentionally neglect the women. We have considered them. This is why they have advisor, they have other positions, but they are junior position, and they are claiming for a cabinet membership, which is a legitimate claim. We'll study it, and I will discuss it with the SPLM caucus, and something must be done about it.
Governor Aguirre says he will make some adjustment in his government in order to give room for more women, but he warns that not all the women's demands will be met at once. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng reporting from Juba.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is set to travel to Africa this week. He will meet with leaders from Chad, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Nigeria during his travel from 6th to 13th of March. VOA State Department correspondent Nikki Ching reports.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's travel to Africa comes after the recent mass kidnapping of schoolgirls in Nigeria. State Department officials say finding ways to combat such incidents and promoting counterterrorism and security cooperation are high priorities for the top U.S. diplomat.
Secretary Tillerson will meet up with leadership in each country, as well as the leadership of the African Union Commission based in Ethiopia, to further our partnerships with the governments and the people of Africa. In particular, he plans to discuss ways that we can work with our partners to counter terrorism, advance peace and security, promote good governance, and spur mutually beneficial trade and investment.
The United States recently put several affiliates of the Islamic State terror group in Africa on the terrorism blacklist.
Africa has traditionally been an area in which terrorist groups have operated. And part of the reason for that is because they assess that they are able to move across borders undetected. What we've tried to do is stand up the capabilities not just of military authorities in the region, but also border security authorities and law enforcement authorities in the region.
According to the State Department, five of the world's 10 fattest growing economies are in Africa. By 2030, Africa is expected to represent about one quarter of the world's workforce and consumers. But experts note more must be done to take advantage of this growth.
The continent needs to work more harmoniously in dealing with issues related to health care, to conflict, to strengthening trade, and breaking down tariff and economic barriers that prevent the continent from realizing its potential.
Tillerson's trip is also seen as a good opportunity for the United States to reaffirm ties with African nations, particularly after President Donald Trump referred to the continent and Haiti in a derogatory manner earlier this year. Nike Chin, VOA News, the State Department.
The UN Refugee Agency has launched a nationwide biometric verification system in Uganda to make sure data gathered about refugees and asylum seekers is accurate. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Uganda provides protection to about 1.4 million refugees from South Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Burundi. The government has been praised for its generosity and open-door policy for people fleeing conflict and persecution. But a major corruption scandal last month, reportedly involving millions of dollars and the exploitation of refugees, has tarnished the country's image and cast doubt on the credibility of its asylum policy. Four government officials have been suspended and are under investigation. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Barbara Balosh tells VOA, "The biometric verification system is important to fix discrepancies in Uganda's refugee data." He says this new registration process will ensure that thousands of refugees who are arriving daily in Uganda receive the assistance to which they are entitled.
The issues that we have conveyed to the government of Uganda, it included allegations of misconduct and fraud and corruption as well. There were many questions around the credibility of the data which is in Uganda's government registration system. UNHCR used to do registration until 2015. Then Uganda took it upon itself, and since then we have been raising issues.
Earlier this year, Balor says Uganda's prime minister accepted UNHCR's office to put in place the latest biometric verification system. Registration has begun in the Oruchingo refugee settlement in Uganda's southwest region, home to thousands of Congolese refugees. The UNHCR says this massive exercise then will be rolled out to cover more than 30 locations across the rest of the country. It says biometric checks also will be introduced at 180 food distribution sites. The process is expected to be completed by September. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Abie by Nyankol Matiang. We have been listening to Nyankol Matiang singing about the disputed Abia region. John Tanza in Washington, thanks for joining us. Would like to hear what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.